All right, shall we begin? Right. So, as Tommaso mentioned, these Monday discussions are meant to be not formal talks, but more to try to bring out some discussions of some of the key themes or questions that we might want to focus on. Or at least some subgroup of us might want to focus on during this program. So obviously, by the title here, I mean to be somewhat provocative, and so others should certainly take that opportunity as well. And so my goal here is really to bring up some questions that have been sort of underneath under my craw for quite a while now, and to try to see what we might be able to do to make some progress. So, well, this title is in honor of, perhaps for some of you youngins who don't know about this famous article that was printed back in 1996 in Physics Today by Serge Haroche and Jean-Michel Raymond, back in the early days of quantum computing. And this article, I think, did quite a bit for, from my perspective, of helping us to clarify our thoughts about what was really, what was necessary, what would be necessary in principle to make a quantum computer work. Because, you know, quantum computing, the idea, Shor's algorithm came out in 1994. This was before error correction. And there was real question whether, in principle, a quantum computer could actually be produced. Would, in general, the sensitivity to decoherence that would necessarily be there in the quantum states in a quantum computer be as computationally complex to protect as to make them? So at the end of the day, you would never get any computational advantage. In principle, a quantum computer would be useless. And this article came out before or just around the time of fault tolerance. The ideas of fault tolerance had not yet, if you read this article carefully, they understood quantum error correction, but they, if you read it carefully, what it's clear they didn't yet understand that there could be fault tolerance, that the actual process of doing quantum error correction wasn't necessarily exponentially complex. And so this article, in my view, helped at least me and perhaps others to really understand. I mean, there's issues of practicality. I don't really want to get into that. The issue, you know, maybe Serge Haroche still thinks is completely impractical to build a quantum computer. We can argue about that. But I don't think we can argue about whether, in principle, it can be done with a polynomial set of resources. I think we agree it can. Might be hard, but it can. And so what I want to now, I don't think we've had that debate about what people call quantum simulation. All right, I'm people too. But so one of the questions is, what is a quantum simulator? We'll get to that, maybe. But I do believe it's necessary for our community to have a vibrant discussion, debate, about what are the constraints on a quantum simulator as critical as we've had for what is a digital quantum computer. And I don't think that discussion has happened yet.
It's funny, you know, remind yourself about that article and the Nobel.
We were all thinking about it. Okay, so, you know, Haroche wasn't the only person. Many people had some big question marks about quantum computing in the early days, and one of the famous ones is Ralph Landauer, who is very skeptical about quantum computing. And he wrote this article where, you know, he basically said, is quantum mechanics useful for computation? And what he was really worried about was the question of whether a quantum computer is really an analog computer, because it's really just looking at the evolution of wave functions. And he knew quite well that there were real problems with an analog classical computer, and making a computer that depended on the continuous operation of a wave function, in a sense, even if it was an entangled wave function, would necessarily be so prone to errors that it would be useless. And I, you know, you can find anything on the web. I heard just from Paul Brummer that you can find me on YouTube. I didn't know that. But you can find Scott Arison's talks on when you Google them. And so I stole this slide from one of Scott Arison's talks. Scott Arison is a computer scientist, information theorist, quantum information extraordinaire, this person at MIT, if you don't know him. And, you know, so these are some quotes he's worried about. He said, you know, well, he meets lots of distinguished physicists. So the quantum computer is obviously just a souped-up analog computer with continuous voltages, etc. Okay, so one of the things we know. So what I'm ultimately going to get to the quantum simulation question. I've been focusing on quantum computation, but I'm going to connect this at some level to quantum. What we might call quantum simulation, is it's important for us, I think, to explore and probe and question what a device that operates under continuous physical evolution, what we might call an analog computer, what is it capable of doing? And do we really trust that it's capable of doing that? So, this was a paper I dug up from the web from 1986, where basically they were proved the following. What they showed is that they could make a device basically based on turning gears and having some stops on those gears at the end so that there would be certain constraints for the problem, that in principle could solve 3-sat. Now, 3-sat is a known problem from computer science that is NP-complete. But what they proved that if this device is going to do it, it's necessarily going to take an exponential amount of resources. Okay? So this is really the question I want to get at in thinking about quantum simulation. Yeah, Tom? Mm-hmm. Indeed. There's many different things. It could be, so here's some of the points, just to reiterate that. As you were just saying, the ideal equations are imagined to have infinite precision, and that's one sense of infinite resource. To what, and I think from a practical point of view, it's a question of to what degree of precision do we need to be able to measure or turn these gears in order to extract the answer. And that's, of course, intimately related to the issues of errors, right? Because if you're never going to be able to control everything, measure everything with infinite precision, prepare, control, measure, those are the three steps with infinite precision, how does that ultimately restrict the set of problems you can solve? And I think it's fair to remind ourselves that Shannon developed digital encoding of information for the very purpose of trying to control errors. Okay. That's right. So here, and that's another slide stolen from Scott. And I wholeheartedly agree with this statement. A quantum computer is not analog. It's not analog. Even though the Schrodinger equation is, you might say, is an analog equation. We're not actually solving exactly the Schrodinger equation. We're digitizing. The digitization of Schrodinger's equation for n qubits into n qubits with a finite countable gate step that we can then detect the errors on, what is essential to make it fault tolerant. At least I believe that's true. Maybe not. That's part of the discussion that we can have. I'm not sure. I mean, of course, one can ask the question, can I approximate a Trotter expansion from a countable gate set through some Solovay-Katayev type algorithm, which well approximates any unitary within whatever the SU2 to the n that I want to make. If I cannot do that efficiently, then I would say that the digital computer can't really compute an arbitrary Trotter expansion fault tolerantly. I don't know if others would agree with that. That's right. Okay, so, from my perspective, is a quantum computer analog or digital? I'd say it's both. And I think that's sort of what gives a quantum computer its power. In the sense that, there's this, loose picture that we sometimes give about quantum parallelism, meaning that all the branches of the wave function can explore all of the different alternatives, and that's a kind of analog business. But at the end of the day, when we measure it, we get one of the alternatives. It digitizes, and we can make use of that digitization to do this in a fault-tolerant manner, which we couldn't do if we didn't have that collapse. And that's what makes it powerful, in my view. Okay, so now to quantum simulation. This is, of course, a more nebulous subject. At least to me, it's nebulous. I don't think we've yet exactly defined what we mean by this. But I think we have some. It's sort of like, pornography. We know it when we see it. Only in that sense is it like pornography, sorry. So the idea, I think, why one is interested is that, of course, there's complexity in quantum many-body systems, and there's the whole notion of emergent phenomena, and we would like to understand this better. We don't have models that we can use, mathematical models that we know how to solve efficiently. And so we'd like to get at them in some other way. And of course, Feynman is the deity we wheel out at this purpose, at this point. The idea of a quantum simulator is that somehow we're going, so let me go to this next slide. We might want to understand hypertemperature superconductivity in a cuprate. That's maybe our goal. Now, how are we going to do that? Well, one way we might want to do it is we have simple mathematical models like some Fermi-Hubbard model that we hope or we think or it's been conjectured that that Hamiltonian exhibits the properties that are associated with the cuprate, maybe. I mean, it's not, obviously, it's not a model of a complicated high-temperature superconductor, but it's the idea that this Hamiltonian can exhibit some of the same properties that are in this real material. So I want to distinguish here the idea of, in some sense, what I would call a solver from by emulation, by simulating. I'm not trying to one isn't trying to simulate this complicated material, but I want to restrict my attention to the question of, I'd like to know something about that mathematical problem, okay? I might want to know what's the phase diagram look like? What are the critical exponents associated with that, with those quantum phase transitions? What is the ground state, and what is the energy gap to the first excited state? That's maybe what I want to know about that. And so the idea is that I'm going to try to engineer some physical system which obeys that Hamiltonian, and by preparation, control, and measurement, extract from this set of, say, cold atoms, those quantities. Yes, Paul. What do you mean you can do it? You can. Well, I think it's the very last statement that we might differ on. You could write down, we know that's a darn easy Hamiltonian, and we can certainly write down the Schrodinger equation for it. But we don't know how to efficiently solve that Schrodinger equation when we have too many fermions. We have, you know, the whole enterprise of many-body physics, which has been for decades developing approximation methods to hopefully gather good approximate solutions, quantum Monte Carlo, post-mean field theories, what have you. But to actually just brute force turn the crank, it just scales exponentially hard to our knowledge with the number of degrees of freedom. So while in principle we can write down what the algorithm is, it's not an efficient algorithm. It grows exponentially with the number of particles. Well, I'm not sure what you meant. It's harder to solve that. If you go back to your problem with the digital circuits, that was harder than the digital solution to the differential equation. I don't think that's correct. I think it's actually easier to do it. It's just that it's actually not reliable. So that the errors that you would accumulate in signal to noise in your analog circuit processor wouldn't actually give you the correct answer to the differential equation. So the idea here is, in some sense, I do agree, back to the future, but instead of dashpots and resistors and whatnot, it's cold atoms and lattices. Now we have some comments back here. Yes, Brigida. Yes, Tommaso. Well, I mean, of course, semantics is something we can argue about. I'm talking about the same kind of experiment that, say, has. I'll give you the. At the end of this, I wanted to end with the discussion of, for example, the recent experiment from John Bollinger, where they looked at Ising Hamiltonians and simulating or emulating them. What I mean by this. But the word is that I have a model, a Hamiltonian in particular, and just for the point of view of specifying something, I have a Hamiltonian, and I want to understand some of the quantum properties that follow from that Hamiltonian by designing a quantum system to the best of my ability, actually, whose dynamics are governed by that Hamiltonian, and that by the appropriate preparation, control, and measurement, I can extract the information I want. I'm calling that quantum emulation. Yes? Sure, I agree. That's why I called it a model. You called it a fake, I call it a model. Sure, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right, sure. But that's a different, I think that's a separate question that I don't, we couldn't get into that. My goal, as I was trying to emphasize, is not actually to simulate the cuprates. I should have put an X here. That's not what I want to do. All I'm trying to do at the moment is ask the following question. To what degree can I extract the information I want about this Hamiltonian by doing this experiment? So what I'm trying to get at, so let me maybe return to one point. So here's a paper from Franco Nori and collaborator, which I would say is the common lore, okay? And the quote is, in general, quantum simulations do not require either explicit quantum gates or error correction unless accuracy is needed. Thus, quantum simulation is typically less demanding than quantum computation. Even with tens of qubits, 4 to 6 even, one could already perform useful quantum simulations, whereas thousands of qubits would be required for factoring even modest numbers in Shor's algorithm. Really? Maybe that's true. That would be awesome. But I'm not convinced that that's true. That it's true that we don't need the same level of control and error suppression to do a useful quantum simulation.
That comment is really not based on a deeper insight.
No, it's not.
It's sort of formulating the common knowledge.
It's a sense. That we have.
It's well founded for some problems, right? If you're trying to simulate, if you have some system and you're interested in reproducing some aspect of that system that is robust at thermal fluctuations,
uh-huh.
For instance,
mm-hmm.
then that necessarily. necessarily means that you're not looking for just one quantum state.
Agreed.
So in factoring, you're looking for one state at the end.
Right.
But when you're simulating some other physical system, you may be looking for some thermodynamic phase that is robust to perturbations.
So here's the question I have. I call this an analog quantum emulator. I believe it is analog because every aspect of it, we prepare initial state, we do some control, we measure, all of that's done without digitizing the information. And the question I have is how robust is that information for what we seek to extract, okay? And then there's a further question, is that robust information actually something that we could have gotten out efficiently, classically, if we restricted ourselves to those robust situations. So this is maybe coming to your point, Kevin. How do we actually extract information from a quantum processor, be it a digital quantum computer versus an analog quantum simulator? Not at the moment, no.
And you are you calling an analog quantum simulator, so quantum emulator equals in the three lines analog quantum simulator?
It does. So what an analog quantum simulator is, in the common language of that term, is what I would call a physics experiment, meaning that you have some many-body quantum system. You prepare it in some initial way. There's some dynamics, perhaps, and then it's measured. But none of that's done in a way that digitizes the quantum state in a fault-tolerant manner. So the way I look at it is the following. So this sort of comes to maybe, Kevin, what you were suggesting. When we do a quantum computation, what we're trying to do, the algorithm for a quantum computation, a good quantum algorithm, is one such that at the end of the day, we can measure the quantum state in the computational basis, and that the probability distribution of different computational outputs, so x there are bit strings, that probability distribution can be easily sampled, and just with a few runs of the quantum computer, we can get the probability distribution, okay? So in Shor's algorithm, you know, we need to find the period of whatever the function is, and we have to sample that. So if it's an awesome quantum algorithm, we just have to run it once because, you know, all the probability amplitude is in one computational basis state, but typically it's just concentrated, and we just have to run it a few times to get our confidence right that we've gotten it. So now, that means to make that probability distribution sufficiently robust, you know, there's only maybe one quantum state that has the right probability distribution. We really have to make that quantum state. Whereas, typically, in a quantum simulation about a many-body system, that's not the kind of probability distribution we want. We might want to extract some correlation function, like a spin-spin correlation. And we want to sample that appropriately and from that deduce the quantum phase diagram or the critical exponents or what have you about the many-body system. So the question to my mind is, when is this quantity sufficiently robust to the inevitable fluctuations that there will be in a non-error-corrected, non-fault-tolerant quantum simulator? And are the places where this is relatively stable to those fluctuations the very place where this is easy to calculate, and that when in fact we're near a quantum phase transition where we really don't know the answer, that's where this is in fact the most sensitive to those fluctuations and thus not robust to the analog nature of the system? Yeah?
Well, I'm not sure I understand what you mean by fault tolerance or error correction in this scheme.
In which scheme? The emulation?
Sorry, no, where you have analog.
Well, you don't, is the point. So you would have to, we don't in the ways that I know it. I mean, could we build that in? I don't know. Maybe we can, that would be great. Yes, Hans. No, I don't.
Because, if I can summarize your concerns and your questions, at this point I see basically can we really trust the form of simulation? Because we don't have a threshold theorem, and we have no intrinsic method to make it robust as we have to form the profound. And I share this concern. And we have these discussions about it. But now, thinking about, I'm wondering whether the concern is really goes to the right direction, because on a somewhat more remote, a higher level, we could also ask this question towards quantum computing. You know, people are asking these questions. You know, how can we trust if somebody comes and says, "Here, I have a quantum computer running on 100 ions." How can we trust that what they do in the lab is really quantum computing? And this goes to the problem of verification, you know, and they should in principle be able to prepare any quantum state of this big system, and we should be able to verify it. Now,
I'm not sure that, okay, go on. But
so then we do have some problem in quantum computing to verify, you know, that this is really a device that can realize any human theory. And I do think that for both systems, maybe it's not, I'm not even sure whether it is a major concern or whether it resolves itself into some problems about general scientific method. And this is a problem. So if we, you know, I think quantum error correction has not solved our problem whether or not we can trust the quantum computer, but we have to be convinced that we can make it really stable, robust against noise. You know, the question is there, if somebody comes and says, "I can do it with 100 ions," we still have to challenge the guy. One way of challenging the guy would be to give him a hard problem that we don't know the solution for. Factor this number.
Mm-hmm.
If he comes, if she comes and we are pretty convinced that it's a useful machine in any case.
And actually, yeah, I don't care if it's a quantum computer. If she got it factors, then who cares if it's quantum or not?
I would trust it's a quantum computer because, first of all, I follow the kind of experiments that I've done, and now they do something good. Now, a quantum simulation may be similar. I think the entire purpose of that. Let's really talk about the analog quantum simulator that Tommaso has taught us and what you call the simulator. Isn't the basic idea of this field of research is that, you know, you can realize certain quantum many-body inequalities in physical systems like optical lattices on which you have very high level of access and control. And there is theory around that these Hamiltonians or others do describe interesting other systems, like, you know, ones that discover rates and systems that might show, you know, high temperatures of productivity. So what people are doing and what they will be doing is play around with that system of the lattices. And they may see, and I guess that's what's going to happen further, they may discover, well, you know, if we have these parameters, there are really strange correlations going on. And you can expect them. But that would mean, if our theory is correct, that in these upgrades or in some other material, you would tune, you know, your power that is there, you should observe something similar going on that might indicate a new phase of there. And then they will do it. And if they find something there, that is the purpose that this quantum simulator has served. And nobody will ask, you know, how robust was it. And in the sense that always we need, at some point, we need a verification step. That usually is the experiment or new structural insight into something that is then checked, tested on these systems that are simulated. What you have in mind, or what I also have in mind, is you know, this trustability thing, and it's maybe a little bit too abstract. It is similar as the state verification problem, I guess. And I'm not 100% sure.
Well, I have some, but I want others to discuss. Yeah.
Seems to answer the question you're posing. How can we test whether
I mean, my answer to that is, if I make the quantum computer, if I give it NP, put problems in NP, then I'm happy, because the computer can check. And I don't care if it's a quantum computer or not. I don't care. Frankly, I don't care. All I care is it's solving a hard problem. And I assume that it's using quantum because I believe that a classical computer couldn't factor these big numbers. So that's enough for me. And my question about what this is about, I don't think it's an abstract question. In my view, the point is, I have a very concrete problem. I want to know, what is the critical exponent of this quantum phase transition? Now, I think it's too much for us to ask of these quantum emulators to explain coup rates. I think we're not going to do an experiment on a optical lattice, change some parameters, and then someone is going to go in the lab, do something in the coup rates. My view is that's very unlikely. What we're more likely to do is to be able to try to get our optical lattices to solve the Fermi-Hubbard problem, if we do it properly. Yeah. How many euros? No. This one. No, it's not the question of whether you could trust the Schrodinger equation, it's whether you can trust you're actually not implementing your exact Schrodinger equation. You're implementing a slightly perturbed version. And so it's a slightly perturbed version gives you a close enough answer to the real thing. Yes, David.
There are reasons. You might ask, why do you test the Hubbard model?
Yes.
The Hubbard model is not the coup
rate. Sure.
It's a very crude.
Indeed. Yep.
And there is no answer to that.
Right? Yep, there isn't. That's right.
And the reason is robustness and even the sound of the system. We know from, the time, change the parameters of the physical system a little, nothing much changes. Right? The general is it. And then there are issues of universality. The system is mature, that you could imagine an enormous class of relations that if you start with, both in the Hamiltonian and in the simulator, which are not going to affect the universal long range things you're actually interested in. So, this is a very interesting question. What are relevant perturbations? What is the class? Have you protected yourself by symmetry against unstable modes and relevant perturbations? And it's what theorists do all the time. That's how they make their living. Write down some kind of approximation, it is robust in the sense that there aren't perturbations if they have fine tuned to zero, then it's robust.
If we
theoretical physics, you were just asking, actually, I have this Hamiltonian, which is a diagonal piece of paper, which is very crude, hopefully.
Yeah.
And then I have this physical system which I've constructed logically, and are they in the same universality? Most of the arguments, people who design this, where the cooperation now with the convinced by the physics community might well, are aware of these things, and when they design these simulators, they take that into account. So they don't prove theorems of fault tolerance, but they're very careful to protect themselves against obvious sensitivities. So I don't see that this is any more a question you can ask, why is the Hubbard, Fermi-Hubbard?
I guess I would look at it a slightly different way. It's not the question of whether the problem is interesting or not. It's whether the things we want to learn from our simulators. There are some quantities of the many-by system that are no doubt robust. But I don't believe all properties are robust. And so the question is whether the perturbed class of systems that we measure are sufficiently robust around the regions that we want to do those measurements that we will be able to trust that this is something we can extract from the system with confidence that I could put an error bar on. Yeah, sure.
Does this trust issue regard how we actually going to proceed in the coming years, or are we simply moving on and we'll find out in the end what's happening? Or that is there some sort of fault on the road that determines what we do?
I guess I can come to you in a moment, Tommaso. The part of the discussion that I'm hoping to generate here is, no doubt, we have theoretical physics and the enterprise of many-body physics against matter, whose wisdom we should be relying on and understanding in the enterprise we're attempting to do in quantum simulation. But in addition, there's ideas about computational capacity of physical objects. There's the Church-Turing thesis. And if indeed, in my view, we can extract something from an analog experiment with confidence that in some sense gives us a quantitative number, that I call that a computation. And if that can be done in an analog fashion, that's saying something very powerful about the physics of computers, to my mind. And that's somehow, once we get to quantum physics, different from the gears and pulleys that I use, we thought the gears and pulleys were not robust enough, but the control of optical fields and collisions of atoms and taking a picture of density, that's sufficiently robust that it actually will be a computation in an analog fashion. Tommaso.
Certainly, there are problems for which we
$1 billion if you squander it on like three qubit digital quantum signals, or if you can get 20 or 30 qubit analog.
Right, but that,
yeah.
I'd like to move the discussion about what the funding agents should or shouldn't do. And instead, I just want to, Paul, let me just, I just want to finish this one slide, okay, if I could, and then I'm done. It's really, I'd like to understand fundamentally how we interpret our experiments, how reliable our, what we should understand about such experiments. Here's a recent experiment I just thought it'd be useful to discuss, just as a concrete example. That's similar in spirit to the one, the Emanuel Bloch experiment that you were mentioning. So this is out of John Bollinger's group at NIST, where what they're looking at is an Ising problem, a 2D Ising problem. And the way, and they're, so this problem is generally, well, I don't have any pointer. Anyway, this problem is on the 2D lattice is generally computationally very hard problem, okay, to find the ground state. Is it? It's NP hard to find the ground state. That's right. It's a completely connected graph. No, they're well-defined couplings. No. Okay, well, I was under the impression that this was actually not soluble, but it's on a completely connected graph of, in this case, about 300 spins. Or sorry, are they constant? They're tuned any way he wants. It's a spin glass, indeed. Okay, so what they do in this experiment is they can tune the strength of these couplings in such a way that mean field theory works well, or mean field theory doesn't work well. Okay, and so there's a very particular experiment that's done. In this case, these JIJs are created by forces that are applied to the ions by laser beams that are put at particular angles, and the optical forces together combined with the Coulomb interactions between the ions are engineered in a very particular way to make those JIJs. And then they calculate, so the weak, when they say the weak ODF, that's the optical dipole force, that's where mean field theory works, and they call this experiment their benchmark. So they can show, because they could do the calculation in mean field, and they show that their experiment is well enough controlled that, in fact, what they measure in these oscillations is what is predicted from mean field theory. The strong ODF regime is one which they don't know how to calculate. So they don't have any curve here to compare it to, okay? So the question is, in my mind, is, okay, so what do I learn from this experiment? How can I be confident that this is actually the appropriate wiggles associated with the time dynamics generated by this Hamiltonian when it was outside the regime that was well defined by mean field theory? In fact, you know, they go through a whole in their supplemental material about how they align this you know, these angles, the wave fronts, exactly with their collection of ions, and if they're off by a little bit, you know, how that might perturb some of these. I mean, this is an analog quantum simulator, and this is not going to be perfect, right? So the question to my mind is, if I don't know, you know, how these wiggles change with my imperfections in the system, what should I make of this? Yeah. So, well, anyway, that's all I have to say at the moment. It's really more, it's really a question rather than an answer. And I really want to learn more about, to understand what, especially in the condensed matter community, in the through the knowledge we have of theoretical physics, of what we feel is sufficiently robust that we can trust what we're measuring about that system. But my gut feeling about it is that this is saying something deep about the Church-Turing thesis, about whether what can physical devices compute. This is, if we're trying to treat this as a computer that tells us whatever we want to know about this Hamiltonian, I would call this a computer. But it's an analog computer. And if an analog computer can give me robust information, that's something, seems saying something pretty strong about the physics of information. Yeah, Tom. I'll sit down now. I don't personally have something to say about it, but maybe someone else does. Does anyone know about this that can say something useful?
Thank you.
there's some results from the Cerulean University that show that even if you include BOSS, you can still get fairly resilient signal. But then the problem is, what Tom pointed out, it's not verifiable. Even if you had a quantum computer, you can't verify the output distribution.
Maybe I'm reflecting on another problem. I think I mean, just to come back again to your initial question, I have to say I think it's very well known. Yeah. The question, you know, your question is what are really the implications of the fact that we don't have threshold theorems for quantum signals? And I would suggest that this question is somehow split up into several ones. For example, you know, we have these notions of a universal quantum simulator, and it was expressed, I think, first by Segal and many times. And then there's an analog quantum simulator that are really different, and ask the same question for the specific system, and then we can say, you know, well, what is the difference? Can come to an agreeable definition of what is an analog simulator versus a universal simulator? If a universal quantum simulator would not need any threshold here, it would be really surprising. Because after all, it's there so that you can compute the time evolution of under any Hamiltonian from any initial state. I.e., you could also simulate the time evolution as it's realized in a quantum computer, which, by the way, doesn't need a threshold theorem to operate. So that would be really surprising. Now, for the analog case, I expressed my concern that this may be the wrong, we might be overstepping, but I do admit that it's, you know, it also has to be somehow formalized. Is something that needs to be figured out. I'm not even quite sure what is the exact definition of what we can use as the analog of the simulator as compared to the universal formalized, I think. It's a way that people agree on sort of what they use it for, but simulating condensed metasystems with quantum systems, for example, versus computing for an arbitrary good rule in the general time evolution. So I would really, I agree that there is something unanswered, but it must have different areas where it's relevant to us now, I think.
I would think that I don't want to say cannot be universal. There cannot be one single type that can get universal analog. So the point is precisely the structure of this guy needs to reflect physically to a certain extent in tunable parameters some other physical system. And you know the digital continuation, the universal one is sort of abstract one in the sense that it is, you know, you make a spin model and something that then of course the cloud. But we can think of a universal digital continuation, we cannot think of a universal analog.
But we didn't say that, sorry, that an analog simulator is just a non-universal quantum simulator. But it's a device that can only access by your parameters a certain class of Hamiltonians, whereas a universal one is capable of, you know.
Yes.
Okay. But then, you know, then the question would be, I would say, really, for the universal quantum simulators, that's okay, and that is something that there's a problem.
Paul, yes.
So, I mean, you're in other words, maybe to say the same thing a little more positively, you could do a simulation of a Fermi-Hubbard model with cold atoms, but getting a test of whether the Fermi-Hubbard model is in fact a good model or if you should have included. So if you observe D-wave pairing in these cold atomic gases, which is a pretty clean instrumentation of the Fermi-Hubbard model, then I could say, yes, this model did not throw out the baby with that.
Is that been done?
No. Yeah, I think yeah, I guess I would personally define analog as encoding your computation in real numbers under the evolution of some differential equation. Well, I'm not sure. Well, I mean, of course, a transistor encodes a 0-1 underneath its analog, but the information is ultimately digitized. So it's not the actual voltage we read. It's if the voltage is between this or this, We truncate it, we call it zero. If it's between that and that, we call it one. Whereas in analog, we allow it to take on the arbitrary real number. You know, David Gross just left, but, you know, there is a, it was clear from his comment and sort of reading his body language as I was speaking, to whatever degree I have ESP, that there is an intrinsic sense that the condensed matter sense, the condensed matter physicists have, is like, we know what we're talking about here. There's universality, there's robustness. We've done these experiments in condensed matter systems forever, and what you're going to learn is important because, you know, condensed matter systems do the right thing because that's why they're interesting. I don't know. Maybe I'm not expressing the logic right, but it seems to me circular. I admit extreme ignorance about condensed matter physics to understand what aspects of the condensed matter problem that we want to extract from the many-body problem are indeed that robust to these, you know, my imperfections in the wavefronts that I'm going to put onto that. And when can I trust it, when can I not?
Well, for example, they try to do these very, very difficult computations of ground states, candidates, Hamiltonians for 2D electron gases, right? Sort of filling fractions, see whether they're supporting not a good one or the patients. And, I mean, the classical computer codes, they can't go very far.
Right.
More, you know, 15 electrons.
Uh-huh. So what should I glean from that?
Well, the fact is that it does seem to be in that case that the role of things like disorder in the Hamiltonian is something that's, the actual ground state that comes out is very sensitive.
That's my intuition about it. I mean, I'll get you in just one moment. You know, if mean field theory works, well, that means it was easy, and I can check it, and that's what they did in that, you know, Bollinger experiment, right? You know, when they were able to check it, they could check it, but when they couldn't, they didn't. So, yeah.
Quantum emulator. feet of the floor turn to get the weak interaction. So you would never be able to say something about the weakly interacting both gas if you want an emulator with just the three folding. So it's the same thing for high temperature superconductive. BCS theory does not describe high temperature superconductive. In some parameter regime, there has to be a relevant perturbation that the physical system has access to. So the new Hamiltonian is something different. But if you just click with BCS theory and change in the parameters, the whatever the S-wave scattering number or something like that, you would never have, you would never get to the relevant perturbation.
So I think that's a different question. Right? That's saying, does I have some physical system and I have a model of it that I can implement in some like emulator? Does that model respect all the physical properties of that the system that I'm trying to model? And if not, then you have a bad model. Right?
Yeah.
So, but I think the question is, given some model and something I can emulate that model on, how do I know the answers I'm getting out of that are the right thing?
Right. There are many questions. What you're asking is not an unimportant question, but it's a slightly different question. The question that I'm trying to address right here is, to what degree can we trust our analog emulator to be telling us that it's actually the thing we want to know about that Hamiltonian? And that could be in, we didn't prepare the system exactly. The parameters that we drove the system weren't exact. And when we did a measurement, we had finite signal to noise. We didn't. When you do measurement in a digital, you actually have to correct the errors in your measurement too. Your measurement is not going to be exact, so you have to do fault tolerance on your measurement. All three of those things, preparation, control, and measurement in this experiment are done in an analog fashion. You cool the atoms down with lasers for some amount of time. You calibrate somehow. You apply these forces. You let the system do something. You put on a microwave. You let the system do something. You take a picture by counting photons. All of that is done in an analog way. And the question I have is, how sensitive are, cause, and that means that there's imperfections at every stage, preparation, control, and measurement. The question I'm asking is, how sensitive is the information that we want in a regime which is computationally complex? How sensitive is it to those imperfections? Jason.
So, I mean, I think we first have to go back to the classical analog.
Agreed.
I mean, there's all sorts of feedback
methods,
there's all sorts of ways that they develop to keep things stable. And also, the theory of probability has to make sure that when you're controlling an analog system, at some point it goes flying off somewhere. So, I think there's lots to learn there. And also, there's ways of making simulations to try and figure out how their error is propagating along as they go along themselves. This automatic error correction, well, error correction.
Yep.
So, you know, how do you know that that's, that really represents a real physical phenomenon or just some effect of the special system you're dealing with? Maybe there are two ways of just asking. One is, of course, to try to build the same kind of system with another kind of experimental apparatus. Another system, not trapped ions, but
superconductors.
The second possibility is, of course, if you are implementing a model which you hope to describe some physical system, then you go back to the physical system and do experiments, try to do experiments in the range of parameters, in a new range of parameters that come out from this emulation, as you say, and then you have to check. So, you know, at the end,
oh, it is. It's an awesome experiment. I don't want to downplay that at all. It's an awesome experiment. And it's, I guess one other thing I would say, so in plot B there, okay, so now that's the dynamics That's the Larmor, that's what they're actually measuring is the amount of excess Larmor precession they have beyond the mean field. That's what that plot is. Okay, so now the question is, what do I do with that information? Do I, how can I extract the quantum critical points from that? Can I get what the gap is in the ground state to the first excited state from that? What do I do with that information? Is that it itself where the hard part is? I'm not sure. Yes, Brigitte. Sorry, I'm here. I see you. No doubt. Sorry, do you exactly what?
They can be quantum in the sense that they'll protect against phase or flip errors on single qubits and multiple qubits.
Okay.
Well, maybe we should, she should get ready for cookie. We'll continue our discussion over cookies since it's time for that. Oh. So we get your palate ready for $2 chuck or $3 chuck, whatever it is these days. All right, very good.